Welcome to the Maris Review. I'm Maris Preisman, and I'm extra excited to have Jen Shapland here today. Her first book, My Autobiography of Carson McCullers, was a finalist for the National Book Award and won the Lambda Literary Award and the Publishing Triangle Award. Shapland has a PhD in English from the University of Texas at Austin, and she works as an archivist for a visual artist. Her new essay collection is called Thin Skin, and it is getting under my skin for sure. Welcome, Jen.
Thanks so much for having me.
I love that your preface to these five essays really lays it all out. Like your editor asked you to kind of introduce the topics that you're going to talk about. And it really comes down to, in my reading experience, the idea that like we live in capitalism and that is a fact. And then so how do we survive, or do we?
Tell me about that. Yeah. I mean, that preface came about after I had finished all the essays, and some of them, you know, they're long and they took a lot out of me to write. Sure. And so at the point when she asked for that, I was like, are you kidding me? You want me to write something else at this point? But I often have that reaction, and my partner makes fun of me for this, because then like 3 days later in the middle of the night, I'm like, oh, actually, yeah, I could write that. And so that preface came together very quickly, but it did take me a long time to really realize some of the threads that connected the essays. Like I knew that I wanted to write about environmental illness and contamination, specifically like radioactive and nuclear contamination in New Mexico. I knew I wanted to write about not having kids. I knew I wanted to write about self-help, but I couldn't quite see like, how are these things related to each other? But yes, capitalism is one of the ways, certainly, like, and how do we make a meaningful and healthy and pleasant existence for ourselves within this very violent system that we're all subject to, and, you know, subject to in different ways and different degrees, you know, of violence, right? And so what really came through that and came through the preface too is that the idea of thin skin, the idea, not, you know, kind of the expected version of that, which is that, you know, idea of being overly sensitive or touchy or something, but more the idea that we are permeable, we are vulnerable to our physical surroundings, to other people, to these larger structures and ideas that shape our experience and our sense of ourselves.
And a big part of that that you get into in various essays is the idea of complicity. And that seems like such a hard thing to parse. Like when we're living in this system and we recognize what's wrong with it and we still participate. I guess a good example is you used to, or maybe still do, like I do, have a weakness for anthropology. Tell me about that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know the last time I've been in an anthropology. It was probably a number of years ago, but I was really into it when I was in high school. It was like this weird place that I would go to sort of escape from my suburban life into this consumer experience that was, I kind of learned through researching in that essay, The Too Muchness, I learned that it was designed really to give shoppers, who were usually young women, different ideas of self, like different ways to imagine their lives. They created these characters. The person who was creating the characters was actually the granddaughter of Charles Dickens, a woman named Polly Dickens, which I thought was an amazing fact. And yeah, they were creating these narratives for, you know, young shoppers to kind of immerse themselves in, and really like spoon feeding the idea that I have been fed since I was born. I mean, anyone growing up in the US in my generation was kind of spoon-fed this since birth if you had a TV, but that buying clothes or buying, you know, these different objects would kind of give you this new life or give you this new identity. And so certainly complicity comes through in that, because, you know, once you become aware of those structures that are shaping that experience and shaping those desires and longings, and then shaping also the belief that buying something might fulfill those longings, you realize that you are very much participating in it. And so each essay has a little bit of that move in it, that realization of my own complicity, that if I literally buy into this, right, then I'm not only like supporting this system that requires certain people to be like basically enslaved who are making these clothes, right? Or other people to deal with the other end of the system where the clothes, you know, that are donated are eventually landfilled in these kind of giant wasteland spaces in different places around the world, that these things that I'm buying into as a way to satisfy some like not very well articulated longing or desire, knowing that the objects will never fulfill that desire, are actually doing all this harm to other people. And so that essay is a way of me trying to like look really closely at the desire. What is it that I'm really longing for? And what are some other ways that we might go about fulfilling it? But then I also really wanted to look closely at what is the effect of this. Like, it seems innocent, right? Like, people talk about retail therapy or whatever, but it's actually like one of the worst things we do, like to a certain extent, like if you really start parsing it out. And so that's what I did. And that essay kind of kept getting longer and longer and more and more complicated and darker as I started to consider the idea of objectification and, you know, how people have been objectified in the US and in our culture and through slavery and colonization. And then the different ways that they're objectified now just through the process of consumption.
Absolutely. And one of the things that you handle so beautifully in the book and in just about every essay is the question of privilege. I feel like that's a bugaboo for many writers, especially if you're a white woman, say, and you're conditioned to apologize, and striking the right balance between acknowledging your privilege, which, yeah, and also being able to get out of the way and tell your own story. It's a delicate balance. Tell me, how did you struggle with that?
It's something I've been wrestling with in my writing since I started writing, really, because some of the first essays I wrote were about the town where I grew up, which is a suburb of Chicago called Lake Forest. And it's a place really obsessed with its own privilege and with its own affluence. And I grew up there in a family that was not of like the same, I don't know, level of affluence as the families around us, as the other people in my school, and with parents who came from a very different class background from the people in Lake Forest. So my parents kind of had all these class aspirations, but then they also had these like really strong roots of sort of like Midwestern resourcefulness, things like that. And so that was like a confusing place to grow up in, especially in the 90s, the early 2000s, which were also a time in our culture of like, you know, fast fashion and material, like, yeah, conspicuous consumption and materialism. So I really wanted to be able to kind of tell that story. And to tell that story meant acknowledging the privilege that I had. And then also the kind of weird feelings of lack that were cultivated within that privilege, which is like one of the mindfucks of consumer capitalism, right? And of our class system, which is that, you know, like even people who not only have their needs met, but who are living very comfortably are still made to feel not enough in all kinds of ways on a daily basis, and then made to feel that there's something that they could acquire that would fulfill those longings.
I mean, just watching all of the media execs, TV execs partying together while writers are on strike. And it seems like now even more so, the very wealthy want to protect what's theirs. I love how you incorporate other voices in this book. In the first essay, we get sort of an oral history kind of feeling. But you also quote many great sources. And you also talk to your friends and kind of report on what they've said. Tell me about all of the different perspectives in the book.
Yeah. So for the title essay, Thin Skin, which is about a variety of different forms of environmental illness and environmental contamination, I spoke to a number of people in New Mexico who are working on either activism or art or science around the kind of ongoing, ever unfolding narrative of radioactive exposure that's happening, not just from Los Alamos, which a lot of people will have heard of because of Oppenheimer at this point, but Los Alamos and the development of the bomb, but also the testing of the bomb, the Tularosa Downwinders, although I don't really talk to them in this book. I focus more on the history of uranium mining, which is kind of this like not very talked about, but much more insidious and long lasting source of exposure. So I wanted to research that, and I really wanted to talk to people who had experienced it within their own communities and families, or who were in some way trying to fight back against it. And so for that essay, which I was working on during lockdown and during pandemic, I was on Zoom with a variety of people interviewing them. And then I wanted very much for their voices to be a part of the piece. I was inspired by like narrative oral history. Jean Stein is an author I really love, who kind of allows these different voices to be woven together and to talk to each other. And so that's what I tried to create with that piece. But then I kind of continued that thread to look at a variety of other instances that related to my own family. So I interviewed my parents as well. So there and there, some interviews with Hazel Johnson, who's kind of the mother of the environmental justice movement, makes its way in. So it kind of weaves around like all of the essays. And each one, I mean, I read so much for each of these pieces, so much that didn't even make it into the sources. Like, and it's like that was sort of the process of writing them, was you know, following this track of reading and following the questions. And so I did want to have those other voices, those other sources, those other texts in there without making it too heavy or too academic, right? Because I kind of came from an academic background, but I'm not writing academic work. But it was important to me that people also kind of have access to these other perspectives, these other voices. And then with my friends, they've kind of learned by now that they're going to find their way into my work, just like my partner Chelsea finds her way into my work. I was listening to an interview with the singer-songwriter Jenny Lewis the other day, and she said, if you hang out with a cannibal, you're going to get eaten. And I think that's one way to describe that. So far, no one's been unhappy with their portrayal, but yeah.
Chelsea does feel like a main character in this collection. And I'm wondering how much input does Chelsea get? Or not at all? Is it a first read?
She's my first reader. And it's funny, she's worked as an editor and she's a writer as well. And so she gives great feedback, but often she gives me fact checks like on our lives where she's like, you know what, that actually didn't happen on that day. And I'm like, okay, but isn't it like much, you know, neater and nicer if it did? So she does have like always the ability to say, no, I don't want that in there, or no, like I don't want you to talk about that or whatever. But I don't know that she's ever used that. I don't think there's ever been a moment where she said, no, you have to take that out.
Well, it's a very lovely portrait. So tell me about Santa Fe as the backdrop to this collection, both for the spirituality of it and the creative energy of it and the wide open space.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, the move to Santa Fe. So I moved here 7 years ago with Chelsea from Austin after graduate school. And, you know, Austin had really changed in the time we'd both lived there dramatically, which a lot of people are aware of. And a lot of cities are going through that same change where kind of the tech industry comes in and everything is transformed and sort of overrun, and suddenly the city is completely different. And so we wanted to live in a place where there was less of a chance of that happening. And we wanted to live in a place that was a little bit smaller, a little bit quieter. And Santa Fe is all those things. It is really unique and strange and kind of a bubble unto itself. But in terms of a place where you, if you're trying to pursue creative practice or creative work, it's really conducive to that. I mean, no one's really asking, you know, what do you do for a living? Everyone's kind of interested in what you're working on, or you know, they're just like really deep into their hobbies. I was like at my friend's house picking peaches this morning, and they have like a little hobby farm. You know, it's like that kind of a place, which I really appreciate. And so, as a backdrop for the book, it did become important. I describe it as a woo paradise at one point, because certainly there are many different forms of healers who've flocked to Santa Fe, and Santa Fe has a long history as a place where people come to be healed. I wrote an essay that's not in the book, but that was about kind of the history of the tuberculosis sanatoriums here, and kind of how Santa Fe came to be understood as this place of retreat, of wellness, of a place for artists and writers to kind of escape. And there are problems with that narrative too. There are ways in which that narrative is often about, you know, white people moving in. It's often a colonial narrative, and it really can discount the perspectives of the native people, the Pueblo people who've been here for centuries, of the Hispanic people who've been here for centuries. So it's a place with a really complicated and living history. That's a negotiation that I find to be happening kind of in real time all the time. And I appreciate that too. Like, I appreciate that there are these conversations that are kind of ongoing within the city and amongst these different groups. Whereas, you know, where I grew up, for example, Chicago, one of the most segregated cities in the country. And it's like not something that in my suburb was discussed. You know, it was a reality we lived within, but it wasn't something we talked about. Here people talk about it, which I appreciate.
I really identified with that aspect of growing up in suburbia and watching the evening news and feeling so much fear that it took me years of living in a city to realize that that might have been manufactured.
Right. Yeah. So the essay Strangers on a Train is really like my reckoning with like sort of some of the lingering aspects of that fear. The sense that when I, you know, take the trash out at night, why am I like watching over my shoulder and a little worried? Like, what is that? Where does that come from? And I really do feel like it comes from that, you know, those very early memories of being made to feel vulnerable and fragile. And that was something that was coming through the news, like you mentioned, the evening news. And then it was also coming from my parents, and it was coming from the rest of the community, this idea that, you know, no one's saying this part out loud, but that as a white girl, I needed to be protected, and I needed to not be exposed to certain realities. And that kind of, that was what the whole town, the whole suburb existed to protect in this way. And then that kind of just like lingers. And if you don't find a way to examine it, question it, and like reckon with it, it could really shape your behavior, you know, even as an adult. Right. And so, yeah, like as I sort of started moving through the world as an adult, specifically trying to travel on my own and camp on my own, suddenly coming up against, okay, what is this fear? I can't stop fear. Fear is a very fast-moving emotion in our brain. But I can at least pause and say, what is that? And is that real? Do I need to believe that? And then, you know, progress from there.
It does feel like a broader, like we were basically, or I was at least, taught not to trust strangers.
Right.
And that is something I've really had to try to undo. Let's talk a little bit more about too muchness before we get to the meaning of life, which is the name of the essay, not just like a thing I'm going to talk about. You touch on this so well, but like, minimalism is so calming and aspirational. And I'm saying this from my 800 square foot apartment in Brooklyn, where you can see we are not minimalist here. Tell me about putting that together.
Yeah, I mean, in the too muchness, I'm writing about excess. So I'm writing about shopping, but I'm also writing about accumulation, like what it feels like to have a bunch of clothes that you can't wear all of them, that in my case were being eaten by moths, that represented like really old and, you know, dormant or like no longer useful aspects of my personality or my identity or my gender expression. So kind of what do we do with all this stuff? Well, the flip side of that, and something that you really find if you look at any kind of design magazine or website, is minimalism, right? It is like an empty white space. And it struck me, you know, the link there between minimalism, between those spaces and whiteness and white supremacy. So I dig a little bit into Anna Chav's work on minimalism and specifically minimalism in art, and what some of the artists, for better or worse, were thinking and believing about the way their work at that time could operate in the world kind of apart from politics. And this is the 1960s, right? So it's like a moment when everything is political, and these certain artists who are for the most part white cis men decided, oh, like we can make work that stands apart from all that and that can be kind of, yeah, in this blank white space on its own. And, you know, thinking about those spaces, the line that comes to mind is Claudia Rankine, and she wrote, "At the bone of bone, white breathes the fear of seeing." So this idea that, you know, somehow inherent in whiteness is this desire not to see or not to engage. And you find that very much if you start looking in the internet for people talking about wanting to purge themselves of their stuff, wanting to get rid of their stuff. They're like, I just don't even want to see this anymore. And so that kind of led me to make the connection. Okay, so there's a guilt here. There's maybe there's white guilt, but there's also like some real like material guilt around the stuff that we've acquired and how it makes us feel. And there's a desire to just get rid of it that kind of goes beyond creating a minimalist space and like can even lead to like wanting to have a bunker and wanting to imagine the end of the world. And the end of the world is kind of like the ultimate minimalist vision. And then you could live on in that empty blank space. And all of that is so deeply connected to complicity, like you were talking about at the beginning, to this belief that like we have wrought something terrible and it is, you know, in some way our responsibility. And a lot of people, when faced with that, you know, the natural inclination is like, let's just wipe the slate clean. But that has obviously a lot of problems in and of itself.
Absolutely. And yeah, I can't help fantasizing about an empty apartment.
I know.
Okay, so I'm a little worried for both of us now, because I think we'll be saying some taboo things here. and you very bravely acknowledged it in your final essay, The Meaning of Life, how against the grainness it goes to say, I don't want to have children, and not say after that, but I love kids.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've been in a lot of conversations while writing that piece and since writing that piece with people who aren't having kids or people who are. And something I did notice with a lot of people who aren't having kids was a need to say, oh, but, you know, I'm an aunt or I'm an uncle and, you know, I love my nieces and nephews, like just like this instant need to like replace the I don't want to have kids with this like, but kids are amazing and I love them and they're part of my life and don't worry, like I'm not a monster, I think is what we're trying to say when we do that. And so that's something that like I talk about in the essay as something I don't want to rehearse, like I don't want to continue that part of the narrative. I want to be able to say I'm not having kids and then move on to talk about what I am doing instead, rather than, you know, then put myself again in relation to kids. Like even the words we have to describe not having kids all have the word child in them. Mm-hmm. Childless or child free, or, you know, there's kind of like no way to escape that structure that kind of, especially people who are raised as girls, are socialized to be selfless, to exist for others, to caretake, and to kind of see our own identity as in relation to that caretaking impulse.
Yeah. And it's incredibly freeing to think about you have encountered this article about the idea of women having it all, of course, and then yeah, like managing the ambitious career and the kids? And what happens if you don't want any of that?
Yeah, I think the narrative, I mean, since kind of the women's liberation movement, since even earlier than that, has been, okay, but how are women also going to have careers? Like, how can they have kids but also have careers? And could they have careers without kids? Like, those are the two items that, like, were being offered. And I feel like that, on the one hand, discounts all of the unpaid, uncompensated labor that women have historically, traditionally, and still statistically to this day do in the home. Like, it just kind of, like, makes that null and void as, like, not a life, not a way to make life, not important, which I strongly disagree with. But then it also makes it seem like, okay, you have to have both the kids and the career if you're going to be a complete and full human being in, you know, this moment that we find ourselves in. If you don't have both, you're a failure in one way or another, or you're not going to have it all. And, like, don't we all want to have it all, right? Like, if we've been raised to believe, like, that we are in all these different ways unfulfilled, like, obviously we want to be fulfilled by having these things. So for me, when I read that article, it was in a grad school class, I just felt insane. I was like, I have no interest in having a career. I still don't. Like, part of moving to Santa Fe was being like, I don't want to be an academic. I don't want to follow, like, the dream of a tenure track job around the country. I just want to live my life, right? Which seems so simple. But yeah, the frameworks that exist in that conversation are super limiting if you're someone who wants to think about what life could look like outside of those parameters, outside of the expectations of career, but also outside of the expectation that family can only look like having kids.
When there are cats, dogs. Jen, I love this conversation, and I wish we had more time, but we do not. So can you please recommend some books for us?
Absolutely. The first book I'm going to recommend is, like, kind of a self-helpy book, which I write about in the collection, and I have a funny relationship to those books. This one's called How to Break Up with Your Phone by Katherine Price. And it's been, you know, I've read so many different things about what being on the internet and being on our phones does to our brain in terms of our ability to read and think deeply, in terms of our ability to remember, to not be distracted, to make connections. But this book kind of, like, lays that all out in digest form and then gives you some strategies for changing your relationship to social media and, you know, the way you interact with people on your phone to try to sort of get your life back a little bit. And I'm finding it really interesting and helpful. The other two books I'm going to recommend are both essay collections that, like mine, are, you know, some of the essays are long. They are deeply researched in their own ways. One is Thick by Tressie McMillan Cottom. It's an amazing collection that talks about beauty and the body and competence and all these subjects that really interest me. And she's really funny, but she's also so sharp and so thoughtful. She brings in, you know, a variety of different voices into each piece. And then the other is Festival Days by Joanne Beard. If people might remember Joanne Beard from her first collection, The Boys of My Youth, which is incredible. And then this new collection came out in, I think, 2021. And it has some, like, long and difficult and winding essays, but, like all her work, it's heavily researched, but not in the sense of having a lot of sources. The source is always her own experience or her own direct engagement with, like, one other person and their experience. Like, but I've never read anything like that.
Like the man Sorry. Who jumps out of the burning building, I was going to say.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And so they're just so richly imagined, and they really make me interested in what else nonfiction can do, what else the essay can do. So those are my recommendations.
I love that. Jen, thank you so much. Thin Skin is out now.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.